With great pleasure that I introduce Shri Chiranjeevi Singh, Director of Archaeology and Museums in Government of Karnataka. He has been Director of Archaeology and Museum for the last 1 year, roughly. Before that, he was the Director of the Administrative Training Institute of Karnataka and was in fact running the many kinds of courses, some of which, of the kind which we have here, and many, many more. So he's not only an expert in archaeology, he's an expert in the whole training programs also. Nothing? Well, he belongs to the IAS, Karnataka cadre, and before he joined IAS in 69, he was teaching German in Punjab University. On completion of training in Bellary, he was first posted as Assistant Commissioner Tarikere, then he was in the Chief Minister's Secretariat, and at one time he was the Director of Information and Publicity. I think I have known you since that time when you were Director of Information and Publicity. Very active director and deeply interested in cultural activities, promoting cultural activities in the state. He has also been on loan to the Government of India for some time and then came back to the state. He amazes me with his capacity for assimilating to different cultures. He's very much a Kannadiga. His command over Kannada language is perhaps as good, if not better, than Kannadigas themselves. I request him. He's been kind enough to come and talk to us on this subject at a very short notice. You might have noticed that I have put him down as a participant in the symposium on violence. And then when we planned to go to Halebid Velur, it just struck me, could I ask him to come and at least describe, say something about the architecture of old architecture of Karnataka? And he agreed to my request, and here he is talking to us on temple architecture of Karnataka.
Thank you, Dr. Sahiban, there's a saying in Hindi, "Hath kangan ko arsi kya," that a bangle or a bracelet in your hand doesn't need a mirror to be appreciated. And you're going to see these monuments tomorrow, so there's very little one can say about them. But then I thought maybe some sort of background information could be given so that you would be able to appreciate them better when you go there tomorrow. I believe you are leaving in the morning and first going to Shravan Belgola and then Belur and Halebid. In time, actually, Belur comes first. So if you could change it to Belur and then Halebid, maybe they can appreciate the development of the style better, because that's the sequence. Yeah, my suggestion would be, if time permits, Belur first. Which is better? Actually, it's a triangle from Hasan. It's an equilateral triangle. So time-wise, you would be seeing some of the greatest works of art tomorrow, particularly the Gomateshwara at Shravan Belgola. Is there any Jain in the group? Yeah, so Lodha would know the importance of this, to the religious importance of this monument for the Jains. I had a neighbor, my colleague from the service, Maharashtra cadre, Mr. D.K. Jain. And once I gave him a photograph of this Bahubali statue, I just couldn't believe the expression on his face when he had that beautiful picture. It was a very beautiful portrait of the face. And now that picture has been framed and is one of the I should say, treasured gifts in his house. But even for other persons who do not have the religious importance or no religious associations for the place, I think truly it is one of the greatest works of art, not only in India but anywhere. And that's not only because of the size. It's the largest freestanding statue. It's higher than the Ramses Colossus of Egypt. But what is most remarkable about the statue is the face expression, which you would see tomorrow. I would come to this later, because this is just a single monument which you would be covering. I would begin with Belur first. Belur and Hoysala, these temples, they are called Hoysala temples. Now, Hoysala was a dynasty in Karnataka, the peak of which was from 11th to 13th century. And there are three major shrines of this dynasty: Belur, Halebid, and the third one is near Mysore, Somnathpura. Would they be going to Mysore? But since you are staying here for some time, if some of you by any chance are going to Mysore on a private trip during the weekend or at the end of the course, please see Somnathpur also, then your visit would be complete, because that is also a very beautiful temple. Now, I am not very sure whether the practice of labeling works of art by dynasties is really sound, because we talk of Chalukyan art or Rashtrakuta art or Hoysala art. This is like calling Hussein's pictures as Indira Gandhi's art, or you know, that sort of a thing. But the fact is, that is how we, for the sake of convenience, divide the periods. One thing which strikes you when you see Hoysala architecture or any work of art carried out during that period, and at the end of it there will be some slides which we'll discuss about, is the uniqueness of this style. It's so different from what has gone on before this and what has come after this. Now, to put it in perspective, in Karnataka, the rise of temple building and artistic activity, so to say, begins from the 4th century. We have elementary remains of the first dynasty. The first dynasty in Karnataka was the Kadambas. 4th to 6th was the Kadambas' time, but very little has come down to us from that period. And 6th to 8th was the Chalukyan period. Now, Chalukyan period, as far as temple building is concerned and artistic achievement is concerned, is perhaps the golden age of India. The monuments from that period are not only the greatest monuments in Karnataka, I should say they rank with the best anywhere. After the 8th century, there was an interlude. Between 8th and 10th century, we had the Rashtrakutas. Although they were a dynasty from Karnataka, their major works are in what is today Maharashtra, that is Ellora and Elephanta. Incidentally, the inscriptions, etc., concerning these are in Kannada. So, for anyone who is interested in the Belgaum issue, this is an interesting point. Any officers from Maharashtra here? There you are. And I may mention that most of the place names, old place names in Maharashtra, are in Kannada. Even Shivaneri, the birthplace of Shivaji, the word Shivaneri is a Kannada word. This is not to fan the Kannada chauvinistic feelings, but just to put in this thing. Now, stylistically, the Rashtrakuta style was a continuation of the Chalukyan style. Chalukyan style, in turn, owes a lot to the Pallavas, because the Chalukyas had got many sculptors and craftsmen from Kanchi. We have the records about that, and the names of some of these sculptors from Chalukyan period have come down to us in inscriptions. But if you look at the Pallava monuments in Tamil Nadu, and right up to Kailash temple of Ellora, there is a certain continuity. And after this break, again the Chalukyas came back to power, and then it was called later Chalukyas. And later Chalukyas then were succeeded by Hoysalas. So, from the time of later Chalukyas, certain stylistic changes started taking place, which got crystallized during the Hoysala period. And Hoysala period came to be a very distinct period in art and architecture, and something which is quintessentially of Karnataka. Today, if you ask a man in Karnataka which age or period or style he identifies with most, it would be Hoysala. In fact, the emblem of the department which I am now heading is the Hoysala emblem. In literature, in music, in dance, in everything, today, the Kannadigas look upon Hoysalas as their very own people, because the Vijayanagar kingdom was basically in Andhra Pradesh, and the court language was Telugu. The Chalukyas and Rashtrakutas went on to Maharashtra and parts of Gujarat. Incidentally, Solanki is a corruption of Chalukya. So Madhav Singh Solanki can trace his ancestral roots back to Badami if he wants to. And Gangas, who have left us this great image of Gomateshwara at Shravanbelgola, they were feudatories of Cholas. Now, Hoysalas were the true kings of Karnataka, whose language was Kannada, whose reign was in what we would call Madhya Desha. As Dr. Saab is from Majha of Punjab, Amritsar, Majha again comes from Madhya Desha, and Madhya Desha in any culture has its own connotations. So this area forms Madhya Desha of Karnataka. Therefore, people's identity with this dynasty is complete. And if you look at what is being produced by craftsmen today in Karnataka, any metal sculptor, traditional sculptors, the idol makers, the carvers, you find that what they are doing is just a debased version of the Hoysala art. Such has been the stylistic power of this over the, and its hold over the imagination of the people. Now, the other interesting thing was that this grew up in an area where you had geologically both granite and chlorite schist. Vijayanagara was basically in the granite territory. Palavas also were basically confined to the granite territory. So granite is the principal stone which they used. Whereas Hoysalas, they went to schist. And that has its own implications, which we'll come to later. Chalukyas used sandstone because it's available, and Rashtrakutas both sandstone and basalt. Now, why I'm mentioning this fact is that the style has a lot to do with the medium. What marble allows you to do, granite doesn't allow. Therefore, the evolution of style has a lot to do with what is available locally. Now, schist, as you know, is very soft when it is quarried. It hardens with exposure to air. And it's a soft stone. You can work very intricately on this. And therefore, the Hoysala artist let his imagination free. It was an unreined free, and the nearest example one can give is the exuberance of Rococo in the Western art. It went even beyond Baroque. If later Chalukyan art compares with Baroque art, this is sheer Baroque and Rococo. There are no fetters on the skill and imagination of the artist as far as this style is concerned. In some senses, it is the antithesis of the classical and the restrained art. Along with this, there is another interesting thing. When the Chalukyan people were working, when those people who came from Hampi to, from Kanchi to Badami, the Chalukyan capital, they had to evolve new forms suited to the nature of the people and taking the softer nature of sandstone. Sandstone, as you know, is softer compared to granite. They were working in a different medium. Therefore, they had to evolve a style which was something unique. They had no models before them. And at that time, the Shilpa Shastras had not been codified. Therefore, Chalukyan artist was free. Whatever he did, he set his own standards, he set his own norms. But over the years, when the Hoysala artists started working, all these canons had been codified, and we had what is known as Shilpa Shastras already codified and in use. Therefore, in some ways, the artist of the works which you are going to see tomorrow were restrained by the canons given in the Shilpa Shastras. They had to conform to the canon. On the other hand, the medium that they used allowed them all the freedom under the sun to do even filigree work. I mean, Ferguson has described it as jewelry work on a gigantic scale. And that's the feeling which you get when you see these works. That's the kind of fine work which they were able to do. But it's a very interesting situation. You have the canon, and you have the freedom which the medium allows you. In the Chalukyan and earlier age, you do not have the canon, but you have a medium which does not allow you to do whatever you want. Therefore, it's a very interesting situation. And I think in some ways, the freedom which the Chalukyan artists enjoyed in not having to bother about the canons, about the proportions, etc., has, from an aesthetic point of view, led them on to something very bold. If I can make a comparison, the Chalukyan art is something like listening to a khayal by Amir Khan or Bade Ghulam Ali Khan, and Hoysala art is like listening to a Siddheshwari or Rasoolan by Thumri. And this is probably the nearest comparison one can make as far as the stylistic differences are concerned. But what I was trying to say was that with all the freedom which the medium gave, the artist was still working within the canon. Now, the canon lays down that the proportions of the body would be only so much. These are called talmanas. The talmanas, that if the head is one, then the body has to be two. You know, the talmana was measured according to the mushti. So many mushtis here, so many mushtis there. And by that time, because of the developments on the agama side, the shlokas, etc., had become the guiding principles, and these came to be known as dhyana shlokas. For example, all these conventional similes, which are called riti shastra from literary side, had given the dhyana shlokas also some material, and you have images like go mukha sharira, which you find in stotras also, or bimbadhara, shukatunda nasika. Shukatunda nasika is the curved nose. Shuka is parrot, as you know, the nose which is curved like a parrot's beak. Gomukha sharira, that the torso should be like the face of a cow. You know, it should look like a cow's face. And like that, the idea was that the sculptor, before he sat down, he would meditate on these dhyana shlokas, because you have to sit in dhyana over what the shloka says. And then you are supposed to derive your inspiration from that. And then that inspiration you have to catch in whatever medium you are working in. Now, even today, a traditional sculptor follows the same ritual. By that time, this ritual had been established. If you place an order for an image today with any sthapati or idol maker, he'll first select a day, auspicious day. Then he would do certain pujas. Then he would meditate on the dhyana shloka, and only then he would start this work. This goes on even today. Now, Chalukyans were free of this. Therefore, what eventually happened was that this freedom, when these later artists, for example, they wanted to look at what the image of Ganesha should be like. Some of the dhyana shlokas, incidentally, just describe the Ganesha made at Badami. So the artist or the writer, he had probably visited Badami at some stage. And then he thought, ha, Ganesha should be like that. And dhyan shalokas describe that. So that's the kind of development which had happened. A change in the medium, a change in the perceptions, and a change in the methods of working. All this had occurred by the time we come to Hoysala art. So it's a highly mannered art, highly structured art in that sense, and yet very exuberant. Now, those who like purity of line, who like classicism, they may find this a bit overdone, over ornate for their taste. But the interesting thing in this, with all this ornamentation, with all this exuberance, with over ornateness, is the marriage of architecture and sculpture. If you look at earlier temples in Karnataka, you have either primacy given to the structural parts, and I'll come to a slide here later on, which shows the development of the various structural temples. Or if it is a cave temple, they were not particularly bothered about the architectural aspect, but more concerned about the utilization of the space and the artistic expression. Now here you have the marriage of both architecture and sculpture, plastic arts, in a very remarkable manner. And that is something which I think you should notice when you see these temples tomorrow. Now, the first temple, the first major Hoysala temple was Belur temple, which you will see tomorrow. The last in the series is Somnathpura near Mysore. And Halebid temple is the second temple, second major temple, which comes somewhere between the time the Belur temple was constructed and the Somnathpura temple was constructed. And most people consider that to be the acme of Hoysala style and Hoysala temple architecture. But personally, I find Belur a much more satisfying experience because it's a live temple. And a temple is meant to be used as a place of worship. It is meant to be used as a place of communion with divinity. Therefore, I find the atmosphere in Belur much more satisfying than at Halebid. Halebid temple could never be consecrated, and it was abandoned before it was completed under Malik Kafur's attacks and all that. Now, Belur, you can see the crystallization of the style and the style being taken to its logical conclusion at Halebid. That's why I suggested that you visit Belur first and then come to Halebid. Now, when this temple was constructed, some very interesting developments had taken place in this area. First was that Hoysalas, they had established their own kingdom. They were not feudatories of any other king by that time, and they had established their supremacy and their independence. Then Ramanujacharya, who was persecuted because of his liberalism in what is now Tamil Nadu, came and settled down in Hoysala territory. He first went to King Vishnuvardhana, converted him to Vaishnavism. Hoysala kings were Jain kings. Therefore, you have this link with the earlier kingdom of Gangas, the image which you would come to last, the Shravan Belgola. So Jainism was the link, but he converted Vishnuvardhana to Vaishnavism, gave him this name. His earlier name was Bittiga, isn't it? Bittiga. And he changed the name to Vishnuvardhana. And you had a whole new philosophy of Vaishnavism, replacing the austerity of Jainism. So I suppose the exuberance which you notice probably is the result of this. I'm not sure. This is my conjecture for whatever it is worth. But Jainism is an austere and a very demanding religion. I'm sure you would agree there. And here you had the liberalism of Ramanujacharya, and you had all the freedom which artistically, aesthetically, and even socially Vaishnavism provided. And then you had the excitement of conquests. You had prosperity in the kingdom through all the areas which you had conquered, so much so that to avenge the insult on his guru Ramanujacharya, Vishnuvardhana attacked the Cholas And he occupied their provincial capital at Talcad, which is now part of Karnataka, and pushed Chola kingdom back. So you had, you know, all this excitement of what was happening all around. And then he must have been a very talented man himself. Therefore, he invited these sculptors from all over the place. And they came from the later Chalukyan territory. The importance of Belur, Halebid and most major Hoysala shrines is that most of the works are signed by the artists. In this case, we know who was the sculptor. And this is something very interesting, because normally it is believed that Indian artist was a faceless person, and he wasn't bothered about perpetuating his name, etc., that he submerged his ego in his creation and all that. Nothing of the sort. Here, the artist put his name right under the statue for everybody to see. And the references are very laudatory. References to the artists. Now, there's a lot of speculation as to why they put their names under the sculpt, under the statues. But I think, again, if you remember, when Michelangelo completed his Pieta, he was a young man and he kept it for exhibition. And next morning he went to see, just to hear people comment about it. And most of the people standing there were saying, no, no, this can't be the work of a youngster like him. This must be somebody else's work. And he was so upset by that, that he took his chisel and then and there on Mary's, this thing here, he carved his name. If you see Pieta, his name is carved here in this position on the band which he's carrying. I think the same kind of feeling probably was at work here, that here, look, we have created something grand and here is the name of the person who created it. Therefore, all these theories about the anonymity of the Indian artist, they break down here. In fact, an Australian has done her PhD on the stylistic differences of these various artists. And I'm sure Patil tomorrow, who knows much more because he has spent many more years in the department than I have, he'll tell you all about them. But we know precisely which image was carved by whom in Belur and Halebid. So this is something very interesting. But the activity still, it doesn't explain how these various elements fused into what we see today. The artists who came, they, as I was mentioning, came from various places. Some came from Ballygawe. The major one, Das Soja, whose works you will see at Belur, he was from Ballygawe, which is a town now near Shimoga. And that was in the Chalukyan territory, later Chalukya. Some came from Gadag, which is in Dharwad district, again Chalukyan territory. Some came from areas which are now part of Andhra Pradesh. Probably hearing their fame, the king and his queen, Shantala, who was an equally talented person, the records tell us that she was an expert singer and dancer and a connoisseur of fine arts and literature. They must have invited them. And since all this activity was going on, they wanted to also share in it. And probably the idea was, well, let's create something new. I think probably this was a commission given by the Hoysala kings to these artists, that whatever they do should be quite different from what has gone on before that. And as I told you, what has gone on before that, from Pallavas to later Chalukyas, is a continuous development. And suddenly you find that although it is a continuity of later Chalukyan art, yet it is something quite different. What went on during those years reminds me of what went on during the first 20 years in the field of various arts after independence. There was a certain exuberance. If you see the situation across the board in arts here, you know, you had the great stalwarts like Amir Khan singing and Madurai Mani Iyer and Subbulakshmi and Maharajpuram Santanam and all those people, Ravi Shankar breaking into his own. And you had Silos Mukherjee and Jamini Roy and Hussain of the Horses coming into his own those days. You know, there was a certain ferment. And I think if you want to catch that ferment, probably the best way is to listen to the music of 50s and popular music, film music. Just see the joy of a composition of C. Ramachandra. You know, I for one think that if you want to catch the flavor of the spirit, the best persons are the popular composers. And the kind of exuberance which you see, for example, in a C. Ramachandra composition, you see in exact equivalence of that in the Hoysala artist's work. Again, as I said, they had become newly independent. They had thrown off the yoke of their overlords. They were feudatories earlier, so they had become independent. They had taken the empire to even beyond Kaveri into what is now Tamil Nadu. And this exuberance and this marriage of various elements has resulted in something which is unique. Whether it is to your taste or not is a different matter. As I said, those who are classically inclined, whose taste runs to more severe things, they may not appreciate this, but what you can appreciate is the form and function combining here and a certain expression which sums up the zeitgeist, if I may use the word. As the zeitgeist of those early years is summed up in C. Ramachandra's compositions, here you can see the zeitgeist expressed in the works of Dasoja, Mallitamma, Madhuvanna, Savanna. In fact, in Belu, there's a very interesting thing. Both Dasoja and his son Savanna worked on some of the images. And you can see the differences in the father's work and the son's work, and yet how unified it is. If you go from one Hoysala temple to another, you can notice the individual artist's work, you can see the uniformity of the style, and yet you would realize that there is something which is binding all this together. As in our classical literature, you know, Sanskrit is the golden thread unifying all. There is a unity of certain aesthetic principles at work, of certain use of space, handling of the elements together, which makes this an interesting experiment. And as I said, after that, the scene, at least in Karnataka, was never the same. Even today, this hospital which you see while you come to this institute, I would say the exuberance which was shown there, the lavishness, not allowing any inch of space to be untouched, you can see it here. But then this is something else again. I can only say that the feeling which is expressed here, the wealth, the exuberance, the need to make a statement to the public. All these buildings also make a statement. In fact, every building is a statement in itself. This building itself is a statement in juxtaposition to that building. But the same kind of statement was made at that time, except that the people who made the statement were very great people. And maybe it was the queen's taste, it was the king's taste, which acted as the unifying thing, which said yes, when the designs were put up to them, yes, this is what is fine, go ahead, do this. Well, these are all conjectures, but I can only compare with what came after that. Hoysalas, in fact, were succeeded by the Vijayanagar Empire. And Vijayanagar Empire, again, it was a mighty empire, the last great empire in the south. They went back to granite because basically they were in granite country. And you have a totally different style emerging, which draws a lot from what has gone on. If you see the ornamentation, if you see the need to show the prosperity through your art and architecture to the people, and to project the role of the king with his divine powers, then the same thing is at work in Vijayanagar works of art, but it's again a very different kind of thing. And what you see today in the south basically derives from these two, the Vijayanagara artists and the Hoysala artists. Interestingly, probably the best wood carver in the Hoysala style is today in Tamil Nadu near Salem. Therefore, the style has traveled. Lot of later artists have drawn their inspiration from this style, but the kind of unified whole that it was at Belur and at Halebid never came about later. Then of course the final thing which you would be seeing is the Shravan Belgola Gomateshwara statue.
I think they are going there first.
Oh, they are going there first. Anyway, Shravan Belgola, this belongs to an earlier age. This belongs to the period of Gangas, and Gangas were contemporaries of Rashtrakutas. So when the great experiments at Ellora and at Elephanta were going on, you see this going on here. There's something very interesting. You have gigantism in evidence at Elephanta and at Ellora, and you have gigantism in evidence at Shravan Belgola. What caused it? We don't know. But if you look at the contemporary age, you have a very interesting example from Odisha also. Sun Temple, again an example of gigantism. You go across to Europe, in this great period of temple building, you had the great cathedrals in Europe. What is it that caused this parallel activity in France, in Germany, in Italy, northern Italy? And then in the Rashtrakuta country, in Odisha, in Madhya Pradesh, the Khajuraho complex, Chandelas, this thing, and a little earlier in time, but this period of roughly about 300 years all across the world has given us astonishingly rich and varied artistic output. Now, the problem which this artist faced, whose name has not come down to us, we only know the name of the Jain saint under whose supervision this artist worked. Whether he was the artist also, we do not know. Whether his supervision was to make sure that the image adhered to the canon. After all, this was an image meant to be worshipped, and you could not take liberties with that. Or whether he consecrated the image, he saw the last stages of the image, nothing is known. All that we know is that the artist, the sculptor who carved this image, himself knew what a great work of art he had completed. And on the last day, he created a small defect in one of the fingers, so the evil eye can be kept away. You know, nazar na lag jaye, drishti, to keep away the evil eye. He deliberately made one small mistake. Otherwise, the figure conforms to all the lakshanas of Samudrik Shastra and to the Shilpa Shastras. And then they say, having done that, he vanished during the night and he was never known. Now, we don't know, these are legends, but the fact is that in this case, we know the name of the person who had this work created. Patil will tell you the historical details. This was got built by Chamundraya, who was a minister, prime minister of the Ganga kings. And later on, they had the enclosure constructed 200 years later. So we have inscriptions about that also, and you will see that. Now, this image posed certain very difficult technical problems. First, the sculptor was working in granite. It was probably a boulder on top of the hill. You couldn't have carted this boulder up the hill. It is in situ carving. It has to conform to all the canons because the image was made for worship. And then it's a freestanding image. Therefore, it has to be anchored so that it doesn't topple over or break, you know. Now, if you pick up a book on Greek art, you notice that one of their greatest sculptors was Prachteles. Now, Hermes and other statues have been ascribed to him. If you look at the pictures of these statues, you find that in freestanding statues, on the side there will always be a brace. If you remember the image of Hermes, you find Hermes standing with the child, and there is a pillar or a column, and then there is a brace, because the image has to be anchored. Now, this is one eyesore which the artist had to put up with. This was artistic compromise, but there was no other way. If you remember the image of Venus, you see that the drapery helps to anchor, and there is a rest for the drapery. The image had to be anchored. Now, what did this artist do? He was a very great artist. What he did was, he showed Gomateshwara standing in tapas. And he shows the passage of time, the length of his tapasya, by showing that while he was standing in that pose in tapas, ant hills have come about. Snakes have started living in those ant hills. Now, again, this is also part of the Jaina canon, you know, ahimsa. So, snake and man and ants. And creepers have come forth and entwined on his legs. He has been standing still and motionless for so long at one spot. But from an artistic point of view, it's a wonderful device to anchor the figure. See, he has fulfilled all the requirements of the canon and yet anchored the figure. This is something remarkable. And you notice in the slide also, you will see that the tendrils of the creeper, they have a small extension here with the arm, and they join. They are the supports with which the figure is anchored. And again, many modern visitors find the image disproportionate. They find that the legs are short and dumpy, the shoulders are broad, and that the proportions are somehow not in conformity with the overall canon. But the artist here was first conforming to, as I said, the Talamana. Secondly, I think he was aware of the fact that the image was to be seen from a great distance. Because earlier there was no enclosure. Even now you see the image from, I think, from 10 kilometers before this, you start seeing the image. And if you see it from distance, all these distortions get set right. Secondly, you are standing at the foot. An ordinary person is below the ankle or somewhere around the ankle, and you are looking up. And again, the perspective, I think, set some of these things right. Probably this was the reason. Of course, the other reason was Bahubali. Bahubali, as you know, even from our earlier texts, the hero is called Ajana Bahu, one whose arms come down to the knees. This is very interesting. Again, if any of you have read Thornbirds or seen the TV serial, there is one sentence there which says that this fellow, when he starts cutting the cane, that all the cane cutters, they had to wield the chopper like this, and their arms get lengthened. Now, maybe these warriors, they had to wield these heavy weapons, and the arms got lengthened, and the person with the longer arm length was Ajana Bahu. Whatever, the fact is that the image is Ajana Bahu. And then, by that time, as I said, the image is 1000 years old. A few years back, its 1000th anniversary was celebrated. Samudrik and other prescriptions which were laid down for an image to be worshipped had to be followed strictly. So if you look at the back of the image, and we have a slide here, you find that the lines drawn are in conformity with the lakshanas of the Samudrik Shastra. Now, with all that, if you look at the face, it is the face of somebody who is really lost in meditation, somebody who is really in communion with the inner self, somebody who is far away from the cares of the world. The legend is that Bahubali was the son of the first Tirthankara, isn't it? And he and his brother, they had a mighty battle over succession to the kingdom, and Bahubali won. And then at the moment of victory, he had an epiphany and he said, well, what is all this victory for? What do I get from this? And then and there he renounced everything, gave the kingdom to his brother, and he became a Jain sannyasi. This is how he must have looked like. Therefore, it's I think one of the greatest masterpieces. If you take a handful of Indian great masterpieces of art, probably Nataraja would be another one. This is one of those pieces, and it's the face which is totally out of this world. Then again, as I said, Jainism is an ascetic religion. There was no question of ornamentation. It's a Digambar Murti. And the real meaning of Digambar, that is clad only by the cardinal points, Dikambar clad in the cardinal points, who is nothing. You realize there, here is open sky and here is Bahubali, and this is what all religion is about, and this is what all great art is about. Therefore, I think this is something which has to be experienced. The expression on Bahubali's face is an experience. And after that, you come to Belur and you see the contrast. Total classical severity on one hand and total exuberance on the other hand. And I think this is what makes any aesthetic experience interesting, because there are no limits to aesthetic experience, and anything can give you that experience, provided you are in tune with that, and provided the artist has been successful in his achievements. Now, here in Belur, which, as I said, is the earliest of the three major Hoysala temples, you find the sculptor and the architect working together, experimenting. Therefore, probably after the completion of the temple, the king must have said, yes, this requires more ornamentation, or the queen must have said, yes, this requires more ornamentation. So you have these figures being carved and being put as bracket figures inside and outside. And again, we know the names of the artists who carved these figures, and Patil tomorrow will tell you, my colleague who is accompanying you. Now, the kind of experimentation you see there, the kind of development of a new style that you see there is something which makes the temple a unique experience, and over and above that, it's a live temple. So you see what a live temple and all these works of art combine to make, because form and function must combine in a great work of art. The temple incidentally had a superstructure, but in 1880s the superstructure had to be removed because otherwise the roof was going to collapse. The superstructure had been destroyed many times, had been rebuilt. Last time it was rebuilt during Haider Ali's time, and then in 1880s it had to be removed. But otherwise the temples, both Belur and Halebid, belong to what is called the Vesara style. As some of you might know, we have three styles of construction in temple architecture in India. The Nagara style, which is the North Indian style, where the shikhara goes
not like this.
And if I may say, Birla Mandir is an example of Nagar style. We have the Dravidian style, obviously, southern. And we have the Vesara style, which is a hybrid style. Now, some of the other distinguishing features are a higher platform in the North Indian temples. You find Hoysala temples constructed on a platform. Now, the other thing was, if you look at the development of temple architecture, initially, at least in the south, the temples were open to the sky. You just had four walls and an idol inside. So first came the roof. Then came the elongation. So you had four walls, then came the roof, then came a hall. Naturally, a kind of mantapa, where people could gather. And pillared hall. So basic arrangement is the sanctum and the pillared hall. And this square formation was the norm even till the Chalukyan days. But Hoysala architects, they had come upon this stone and they wanted to make use of every available inch for their carving. So what did they do? They took one square, put another square on that, and that gave them a skeleton form, star shape. You have eight sides. Within the same space, you have many more aspects now to carve. And then they were not content with that. So what did they do? They made the temples cross-shaped. So you have a line like this near the main shrine and across here, like the name in a cathedral. And you have the supporting shrines here. So you have three additional spaces and you have these eight faces to carve on. And you have a platform, sometimes 5 feet high, sometimes even higher, on which to shower all your skill. Now, all these shrines actually, the best example is at Somnathpura, where the superstructure is still available. We can see that what the original Hoysala temples looked like, because Halebid got never completed. In Belur, the superstructure was demolished many times. And Somnathpur is the pristine example of that. And here you had the Trikuta Chala form. And that is the form which is associated with the Vaishnav shrines. If you remember, when the BJP or Vishwa Hindu Parishad first unveiled the design of the proposed Ayodhya temple, which is designed by Sompure, whose father had designed the Somnathpur temple, you know, the renovated modern Somnathpur temple. And basically, it is in the same style, and it's the same configuration. You have the Shikhara and you have the pillared hall in front. The criticism of the shrine was that this did not conform to the Vaishnav temple style. It had to be a Trikuta Chala style, whereas this is a Shaivite style being imposed on a Vaishnav shrine. But what I'm trying to say is that some of the ideas which kind of motivated the Hoysala sculptor and the artist are still at work today. The notion that a Vaishnav shrine has to conform to these stylistic norms is still at work with us. And all the unity of style, of purpose, of making a statement, I think reaches its peak in Karnataka in the Hoysala style. We would come to the slides now, and after that, is there any discussion or what? Would you like to discuss after you see the slides or before? Yeah, you can come. This is from Pattadakal, Chalukyan monuments, 6th century. This is probably the most important spot in India as far as structural temples are concerned, because this is called the nursery of Indian structural temples. And here you see
the sculptors experimented with various forms.
Now, as many commentators have written about India, especially the foreign ones who study, they say that the problem with the Indian writing about Indian temples is that each temple, each style seems to be perfect in its own right, and there is no period of experimentation. You know, if you look at temples in Odisha, it's complete. You look at temples at Khajuraho, they are complete, or Modhera, or any place. But this is one place in India where you see a lot of experimentation going on. Therefore, this is called the nursery of Indian temple architecture, and you see all the styles developing here.
The Dravida style, which is a pyramidal style, storied style. You have the first story, the second story. And you see the development of the Nagara style. Dravida and Nagara in juxtaposition you find here. Now, these were some of the elements which later on went into the making of the temples which you will see tomorrow, because what you see will be a combination of this and something more, like hydrogen and oxygen combining and water being something more than both. Next. Now this is an example of the earliest extant form of Nagara style, again 6th century Pattadakalpa. But you find that there is no ornamentation. From these plain beginnings, we come to Hoysala temple where not even an inch is left uncarved.
Yeah. That was the example of the Nagara style. This is another example from the same area of the Dravidian style, and we find that here ornamentation and ornament etc. has come. This later on develops into various forms. Now, this is again from Badami. I'm showing this in order to put the Hoysala art in perspective. Personally, my favorites are Chalukyans. But, I mean, as I said, each to his own taste. Most people relate to Hoysala art more. So this is a very interesting image. This is sandstone, incidentally. Sandstone is a harder stone than shipwreck, you know. So, you do not have the kind of filigree work which you will see later, but this is Shiva supporting Parvati. Parvati has taken bhang and she is intoxicated and she has vomited. Actually, that happens from here. There is a dog letting her vomit with this collar and Shiva is supporting her. So the tender sentiment, the humanization of the deities and the sheer composition is something remarkable. And here you can see that these do not conform to any canons. Probably the artist was struck with this. He must have heard, yeah, Shiva was the drinker of bhang and dhatura, and the wife must have joined him at some time or the other, and she must have, well, yes, the freedom of the artist, you see in full measure here. This freedom you do not see in Hoysala. And again, talking of this freedom, you see, here is the artist trying to bring divinity to mere mortals. Now, there are two routes here. Either you can idealize the human figure. That is the route the Greeks took. So much so that Venus de Milo, which is also attributed by some to Praxiteles, is for a long time considered to be the embodiment of the ideal female beauty, and the measurements 36, 26, 36 were taken from there. So I read somewhere anyway, but the fact is the Greek route was idealization. Now, the Indian route was the opposite one. That was the abstraction. Therefore, when you are taking the other route, the kind of realism which you see in the figure of Moses by Michelangelo, or in the statue of Hermes, say the figure of David, Michelangelo's again, you do not see here. What is important here is
the rhythm, the overall essence, the feeling to be communicated, and you link this with our theory of rasas, because there is a certain rasa, there is a certain inner emotion, there is a certain feeling which has to be communicated. So that comes out very strongly here. I think this is one of the most interesting pieces in our entire artistic canon. Now this is again a Chalukyan figure, and you notice the total absence of ornamentation, barring the Kirija and minor distinction. But this is Arthanarishvara. Here you see the elements balanced perfectly. You find that it's the rhythm and the expression which matter. You see the face, you see this, and it doesn't conform to any canon. And yet, I think it's a very great work of art. Just look at the face and you know it is the face of a god. And this was the heritage which the Hoysala artists inherited. Now again, this is, that was in the Prithungi pose, this is in the Samabhanga, that is straight line. So this image must have been for worship. But you see that the artist is concerned with the expression. Something which you see in Shravan Belgula, Gomadeshwara image. Here also, the use of the material, the purpose, and everything sort of combines us to give a whole, which is very noble. Now, this figure is very interesting because this is one of the earliest Natarajas and again Chalukyan. And as I said, many of the Talmanas were taken from many of the Badami images. And this is one of the images along with the Ganapati, and this is the image which has given us many Dhyana Shlokas, which were then the guiding principles for Shilpis even to this day. Now, this is Belur. You saw what was earlier, and you see what is there. As I said, the superstructure has been demolished. But here you find that you have the platform, you have the stellate form, what I explained, and you have elaborate carving all over the place. Now, this is one of the bracket figure. Compare this with the Arthanarishvara figure, which you saw earlier. Again, it is a Bhanga pose. The rhythm is there. Now you see the profusion of ornamentation here. And you find one main difference. You see that the Pramanas are at work here. The Talmana Pramana is at work here. The figure is a secular figure. The image is not meant for worship. Therefore, the artist has the liberty. But because his heritage is now, his training is now to work according to the canon, he is working in the canon. And yet, the liberty that the medium, the softer stone allows him, is the fact that this is an image which is there to ornament the temple. Basically, not for worship. You see what he has done with the material in him. And there are some 24 such figures. The most beautiful of them, which probably they will point out to you in the temple, is that of Queen Shantala dancing. I am not sure whether it is Queen Shantala or not. That was carved by Shamanna, whose father Dasoja has done other 4 figures. Out of 22 or 24 figures, 4 are by Dasoja, 4 are by his son Shamanna. So they are the people who have contributed the largest number of these figures. And then the interesting thing is that, now here you have the inscription. Most of these, as I said, give details of the artists, which make these temples very interesting. Now, it was pin and socket kind of arrangement. So, stone was fixed as you fix something in a socket.
And then, in order to fix the whole thing, like the keystone in the arch, you had the main stone coming down, and when you see the temple, you will see the kind of things they have made of that, innumerable forms. And then, the simple arrangement of the sanctum and the pillared hall, because again they were working with a softer stone, these architects, they took they had the help of lathe. Pillars are lathe turned pillars, and that's another interesting innovation here.
Now this again is one of the bracket figures. This is a contrast. So you see the rhythm. Again, whatever I said about the earlier figure applies to this. But see the diagonal. A bow is here, and the arrow is to be shot at two birds here. Two birds are shown in the tree. Now, there is a very strong rhythm in the figure, which you see even in the drapery here, whatever little of drapery there is, the ornamentation. But here, the tension created by the composition is something truly astonishing. And with all this freedom, the figure conforms to the canon. And again, this is the work of the father, you'll find these figures very interesting. The other interesting feature would be the jali kind of work here. This is another very prominent feature of Hoysala temples, which you'll see tomorrow, and I'm sure Patil will tell you more about it. Yeah, this is again one of the figures, bracket figures, Darpana Sundari. You would have seen this very often. It's used even in advertisements. It's one of the most common images used in commercial world also. So here you see the stylistic differences come, for example, in the treatment of the hips.
For example, Chamanna, the son,
gives a more rounded, a fuller hip. It also comes in the treatment of the breasts. The son's breasts are conical. These are the kind of differences which you can notice apart from the names written down. You can study these stylistic differences of each artist, some 18 of them or 20 of them, whatever, in the three temples. And yet you find that the image which you saw earlier and this one, stylistically there is a unity. That's what I was telling you about, that although each one has his individuality, each one works in the canon, yet works freely, and yet there is an overall unifying thread which you find in all the Hoysala shrines. And this is something which is remarkable about the Hoysala temples and whatever has come down to us. This is another image where the head is damaged, and the story is that when Gandhiji went to Belur, some overzealous fellow trying to show the image to him brought it down. Because as I said, this thing is talking kind of thing, and while bringing it down and putting it back, it acts as broken. So, our hero worship has no bounds, as we all know. Yes, hero worship. And you see the lathe turned figure. This is the other major Hoysala shrine that you will see tomorrow. You see, from the smaller beginning, the role of the image here, and how sculpture has been integrated with architecture. It's a totality. from here to here, actually,
according to the Westerners, Indian temples are really works of sculpture because you have masses of stone and then you carve them. So they, many of these temples, according to them, are more works of sculpture than works of architecture. And then structural temples like the ones, some at Orissa or ones I showed you in the earlier style of Chalukyan temples, where you can see the elements of structural temples coming up. But here you have both the elements truly combined.
There is no element which you can separate here. And yet images have been elaborated. For this minor this thing, you have this, then you have the Dwarapala, you have the tree shrine, you have the stellate form, you have the high platform. So again, all the elements that we have been talking about, the various elements,
the development of the Vesara style, taking elements both from Dravida and Nagara style, the codification of the canon, the marriage of art and architecture, the freedom within the canon, the artist's own ego.
Everything has combined to give you a whole which is total. No element is out of place. Individually, you may say that, for example, in this piece, in the series of pieces, you have stories from Mahabharata, Ramayana, God, and the various forms of Vishnu and Shiva here.
You may find the images sometimes are very rudimentary and all that, but when you look at the totality, the total effect is something remarkable. And the other interesting part here is, the king converted to Vaishnavism. He was a Vaishnav, and Belur temple was constructed as a paean of glory or his homage to Vishnu. The artists who produced those images which you saw were Shaivites. And this temple is a Shaivite temple. So you'll see two temples tomorrow. One Vaishnavite, one Shaivite, and the third one a Jaina one, which is the earlier link, takes back to Karnataka's earlier Jaina heritage. So you see the spirit of tolerance. I don't know, somehow you get the feeling that it's part of the problem today with us is a narrowing of our vision. Here you see a broadening of the vision. You call artists from all over the place, you pick up from various stylistic elements, this one from Nagara style, this one from Dravidian style, you fuse into one whole, and the Shaivites are carving Vaishnavite images, and the king is a Vaishnav. This was constructed by his general or minister, Ketumalla, who was a Shaivite obviously. And all this going on, although one should not take a very romantic view of the things, because many of the Jaina shrines were forcibly converted into Vaishnav shrines. That has also gone on. So what is going on in Ayodhya is very much also a part of our tradition. But what has happened is a constricting of the vision. Here you see a liberation of the vision. I think the best thing that one can say about these places is that it's liberation of vision.
All that I have been talking about, fusion of elements, styles of architecture and sculpture, you see here.
This is one wall. This is again a Ganesha image.
Now this kind of Kirita, these are archetypal Hoysala symbols, and this kind of treatment of vallis and various elements.
This again is an important figure. Yeah.
This is also from. This is a Jaina shrine. an Jaina image where you see the Hoysala style at work, the decoration, the pillars. But maybe it's,
I didn't intend it to be here, but interestingly, you can compare it with the Gomateshwara image, which you will visit tomorrow.
So here, probably the sculptor was as skilled. You can see the unification of style, you can see the decoration. It's a fine work of art.
But then when you see the other one, you realize what is truly great art. Yeah, next. This is an overview of the Shaman Gangola Hill from a distance. Here you see the image.
Can you see some? Then you find that you do not notice any distortion, isn't it? It seems to be off a place.
Everything seems to be right here. But if you see it from close quarters, especially the Western critics, some of them have noted about awkward proportions. But I think the artist knew what he was doing.
Here is what I was telling you about.
See, the image needed to be anchored.
Now he has solved the problem. The technical problem has been made a very beautiful into a very beautiful aesthetic and religious solution. Here you see the joining which is necessary for supporting the structure. So you see how beautiful he has done it. It's a creeper that winds around which is joined. And here you see the snake coming out of the anchor and going in.
And this is what, as I was saying, all great art is about. What you make of what is given before you. And look what the artist has made out of that.
And just look at the face. Forget about everything else. Forget about the size.
It doesn't matter. You can carve big images today even. Some years ago, you probably remember, an equally large Gomateshwara was carved in South Canara for Japan. And to transport that, special bridges were made. Now, if you compare, if any of you have seen the photographs of that, if you compare the face, that face with this one, that face has, if I may use an uncharitable word, has an expression of horror. And this has sublimity.
And this smile can come only when you have realized within you what is truth.
Because then nothing else matters. He has given up his kingdom. He has given up everything.
And after all this long suffer, at the end of it is the realization you see on the page. See, the Lakshana of the parents telling you. The lines here, the lines here. This is also linked with the Tantric canon, because this is linked to the notion of the
Sahasrar Kamala and the 10th Das Dwara.
Now, this is why in Jaina images, you find the shared quality, distance, and
which is associated with ascetical practices as well as with the Samudrik. This one.
And here you can see also the stone cancer here and there. Penny has started getting affected by pollution and by natural weathering. It has weathered. 1,000 years.
Well, actually, when you see, it comes as a surprise to you that it is in such a mint condition.
Yes.
Now they have a protective coating over the image.
This is the inscription at the base of the seat. This is in 10th century Kannada, which says that Chamundraya, not even that Chamundraya had it made. This is in Tamil, this is in 12th century Kannada, which says that the compound was constructed by so and so. We are talking of the strife and these disturbances between and problems between Kannada and Tamil people. This is the historical background. Talk of coexistence and all that. You find Tamil in between 10th century Kannada and 12th century Kannada. Next one. This is the same thing in Marathi in Devanagari. So a friend from Maharashtra can note this. If Rashtrakuta spit Elephanta and Alora, Marathi was equally respected in Shravanbelagola. Yes, this is old Marathi in Devanagari script. Now these are the three shrines which you will see. Unfortunately, we didn't have too many slides because some slides have been taken out of the department, not yet with us, of the available ones. They'll see the real thing. That's why I said Hathkangan ko RC kiya. I've just been giving a background. And the background is that yes, in the long line of sculpture and architectural development in Karnataka, Hoysalas represent something unique. This is the native genius of Karnataka. That is why Kannadigas identify the most with them. It's exuberant because it represents the exuberance of freedom, the kind of thing which we had in the arts in the first 20 years of our freedom. And all the elements have been fused together into a whole. And the marriage of sculptor and architecture, again, is something remarkable in these shrines. And these are the things which go to make. And again, I describe always Karnataka as the bridge land because it's the bridge between the southern culture and the northern culture. You see here the two elements, the northern style and the southern style, combining into one and giving something very unique. This is the significance. And artistically, of course, you have seen some of the images, beautiful images. Whether your taste runs to what I showed earlier, the Shiva and Parvati image or the Arthanarishvara, which is strong classical tradition in hard stone, or your taste runs to this. And incidentally, this is the tradition, the equivalent of this tradition, which you find in Jain temples at Dilwara and Palitana. You have stylistic resemblances there. Again, they were working in a soft stone marble. And the example was here. Its inspiration was already there. And this has influenced the course of art later on, not only in Karnataka, but in other parts also. So this is basically the background. Other details, as you see, Mr. Patil is accompanying you, he'll give you. Now, if you would like to. Yeah. Again, as has been noted by many people, Shaiv art gives you a lesser number of themes because Chalukyan monuments are basically Shaivite monuments. Now, you have various forms of Shiva and you have the representation of family like Ganesha, Subramania, but it doesn't give you the kind of variety which, for example, is associated with the Vaishnav art and Vaishnav cult.
In the continuity of themes, you can say that the Shiva and Parvati in their manifestations is a continuity. Ganapati, you have this big image of Ganapati, for example, at Mamallapuram, in one of the shrines. You have the Badami Ganapati, after which the famous Kriti is composed, Vatapi Ganapati Bhajeham. Vatapi is the ancient name of Badami. So, although Vatapi Ganapati is not in worship today, but probably it is still a part of collective memory. Because, as I said, many of the Shilpa Shastras, they took Badami images as their model. And it has become a part of collective memory. But this is the Shaivite canon is the link between the Pallavas and the Chalukyas. This is all one can say. Otherwise, if you say, for example, the penance of Arjuna, which is the major this thing, that sort of theme from Mahabharata is not there, because on the structural side, things are evolving. You have, for example, the images of flying Gandharvas, very beautiful images. Those who have passed through the academy at Mussoorie would remember in the main hall, there were two plaster of Paris casts of flying Gandharvas. Do you remember? Now, those were from these temples, Pattadakalai holy temples. Beautiful images. You have flying Gandharvas there also in some of the images. So, the motion of flying, the general stylistic, this thing. And in this Arthanarishvara, you can see the stylistic continuation. I won't say unity, at least continuation, because as I said, Chalukyan artists in their freedom and in their experimentation with a new medium, they were working in sandstone, which is softer compared to the hard granite of Pallavas. Therefore, they had more plasticity, and you find there is more plasticity in the images here, and perhaps more humor, as you can see. Yeah, the height, etc., is governed by the canon. By that time, the canon had been codified. The canon laid down, if the head is one mushti, then the body has to be two, the legs have to be three, or whatever. No, talmanas had been laid down, so they conform to that. Coming to the short stature of women, well, I suppose the artists were going by the models they see in life. Men are taller, and this is certain idealization and certain abstracting. As I said, the Greek artists took the path of idealizing the human form. The Indian artists took the opposite path of abstracting the human form. And in abstraction, you take the elements. In the elements, you find that the man is taller, the man is broader. But if you see, for example, images on the panels, there, suppose you see a Shiva panel, and you see next a goddess panel, there it is the same. In the groups, yes, but I think one need not read too much into this, because after all, they were working from life, and in observation from life, considering the notions of man and woman, which persist in our country and everywhere else, even to this day, showing male figures taller than female figures is understandable. Yep. They are Pallavas and Cholas. But as I said, you see, one thing which the Hoysala artists were very consciously doing was making a break with the past. And that is something very clear from this. Now, you see the linearity in the figures. Unfortunately, I have not brought that slide. If you see the earlier figures from Chalukyans, the early Chalukyans and the later Chalukyans, as I said, you had Chalukyas for 200 years, then Rashtrakutas for 200 years, and again Chalukyas for 200 years. Now, in the later Chalukyan period, where Nagara temples you find in Bidar, we have the slides, but not anticipating this question, I haven't brought it. You find the same elongated form of females. it is not that it is not there in North Karnataka. You have that elongated form as you find in Chola and Pallava art, in Chalukya and later Chalukya and Rashtrakuta art. That female elongation, slender limbs, etc., that is there. Not in Hoysala art. Yes, this is, in fact, I think it is Percy Brown who has noted on the squatness of the figures. He says the figures are squat. He finds fault with these figures. He says the proportions are wrong, but the elements gel into something whole. I think probably as conscious experimenters and people who really wanted to assert something different, they have gone in for these. But these actually conform to the canon. At least the canon which is used, the talamanas which are used even today by the idol makers here in these parts.